something that we found that's amazing over the last year is the interest that has arisen in the Large Hadron Collider. In fact, if you look on the Google Zeitgeist, you find that it's more popular than Obama, if you look on the scale of what people are searching for. And Google even commemorated this with a little image on their website.
That's because they didn't think Obama was going to destroy the world.
So you all know the basic motivation. Let's hope not. Basic ideas of nature. This is all obvious to you. Do we have the ability to find some sort of unification of different gauge forces? What is the origin of the masses of different particles? And as you heard today on the talk in dark matter, well, what actually is dark matter? Is there a candidate we could search for at the LHC? Well, you all know if you extrapolate the different gauge forces, different gauge couplings, that they don't unify. You know that they cross, it's easy to get two lines to cross, but nothing seems to cross at one point. But of course, that doesn't stop people from trying. And as you know, if you add in things like models of supersymmetry, it seems, even if you zoom in, a level of one sigma, you actually get some sort of unification. So it's no proof. It's not a smoking gun of something being there, but it's maybe an interesting hint. Maybe it's some circumstantial evidence that we're on the right track. So, well, you all know about the Standard Model, but of course, as you know, there are many unanswered questions in the Standard Model. I mean, what is the reason for the masses of these different particles? I have not seen a convincing theory that tells us why particles have the masses they do. One of you can give us a theory that does that, and we understand the coupling of the Higgs boson, but we don't know why that coupling is there, and of course, the masses of the electron weak particles. So, there are many questions in the Standard Model. Why are there three families? Well, you've all seen the LEP data that it's more or less conclusively favors three families, at least below the mass of the Z over 2. Remember, this was precision data at LEP. These error bars are increased by a factor of 10. So there's really no question, at least for masses below the Z, that there are only three families. But there are, I guess, some models, some explanations of why there are three families, but I don't think we're convinced we really understand why there are three. 2.98. Why are the particles the masses that they are? Well, I'm going to argue just the Yukawa coupling at the top part of the vacuum expectation well, just say it's one over, well, it's spur of two. But why is that? You know, there's no sort of simple harmonic oscillator model that can tell you why the different quarks have the masses that they have. So this is another question. So at least finding the Higgs would be a step in that direction. So this is just a little cartoon explaining, you know, the model of a scalar field. So I tried to think of an example of a scalar field in nature. Well, one example you might say is just a temperature map, the number everywhere in space, which is like the Higgs field. Of course, this would be a very bad model for the Higgs field, because if your coupling is based on the value of the temperature, if you were to go from Montreal to Vancouver, your weight would decrease. So some people might like to lose weight, but that's not a good model. The Higgs field should be the same number everywhere. So, okay, we know where the Higgs is not, right? We all know from the LEP direct searches, it's ruled out below 14 GeV. And one of the puzzling things, remember when you look at the best electroweak fits, and this was the latest from last year, they tend to favor a low Higgs mass around 84 GeV with, you know, 30 GeV error bar. So maybe that's telling us something, that if it's going to be found, it should be found very soon. Now, we certainly hope that it's something we're going to see. I know there are models where there is no Higgs. There are models that Stephen Hawking came up with, that there's a Higgs we cannot see. But if it is a particle that we can observe, it should be found in the LHC or the whole mass range up to over a TeV. Now, this is just a cartoon reminding you of what the Higgs field is like. You can imagine a room of journalists chatting away. That's the Higgs field. Then in comes the politician. In this case, it's Margaret Thatcher. And people cluster around the politician, and that's the argument for giving a particle a Higgs mass. What is the Higgs particle itself? Well, an example people give is you have a little rumor starting at the door, it goes over this Higgs field, and the Higgs field itself couples and gives the resonance. So, a second question, well, you heard a lot about dark matter in the earlier talk. You all know about galaxy rotation curves, the fact that, well, One of the explanations is that there's dark matter. The models, of course, have modified Newtonian dynamics, but there are many, many other examples of why it seems to be some sort of particle. And maybe that's something we can find. This 25% of the mass in the universe seems to be some sort of particle. And as you know, there's a candidate in supersymmetry, the neutralino, that is a weakly interacting particle that might do that. There are many other examples of dark matter. Again, you've probably seen this. The microwave background to large-scale structure, galaxy formation, there are many, many examples of why we seem to believe that there is something called dark matter. Now, you all know about some of the satellite experiments that have come up recently with claims for dark matter. For example, Pamela, as you know, has looked at the positron-electron ratio and also the proton-antiproton ratio, where it doesn't see an excess, but it does in the positron ratio. And here are two different models trying to fit the Pamela data. On the right is an example fitting a dark matter model. And on the left is just taking a sort of standard contribution from pulsars, so no dark matter. And as far as I know, this is still controversial, at least it was when I was hearing about this in January. So it's still, there's still no smoking gun for dark matter. Maybe you can escape it, but you would expect to also see a proton-antiproton excess, which they don't see. But okay, maybe it's a sign that there is something there. So this is, again, just looking at dark matter annihilating in the halo of the galaxy and producing, let's say, positrons. There are other experiments, as you know, but the Attic experiment, the LUM experiment, where they also look at this ratio, and they do see an excess as well. And people have tried to fit models of dark matter into that as well. So there is some tantalizing evidence from telescopes, from experiments of satellites, and maybe we're going to need both accelerators and colliders together with telescopes to find out what dark matter really is. So let's go to the accelerator experiment, Large Hadron Collider. So first of all, here you can see the Tevatron, which is right now the highest energy collider at 2 TeV, while the LHC will be 7 times that center of mass energy. You also see the luminosity, and the LHC will be 100 times the intensity of particle beams compared to the Tevatron. So this is just an example of why you need 7 TeV on 7 TeV. If you're trying to probe TeV scale physics, you all know that the quarks and gluons carry some momentum fraction based on structure function of the proton. So you could imagine getting might be something like 1/6 or 1/3 of the momentum of the proton to get to sort of a TeV on TeV collision. And this is just a little cartoon showing you one way you could produce the Higgs, two quarks radiating W's, making the Higgs going into 2 Z's, which will then decay. The other important thing I mentioned, luminosity, just to remind you, the physics rate of any process you're looking for is the luminosity of a collider times the cross-section. So obviously, the larger the luminosity, the better chance you have of getting a rare cross-section processes. And the design for the LHC is 100 inverse femtobarns per year. So this is a schematic of the LHC. So the first collisions are planned for the end of this year. We'll mention a bit about that. It's colliding billions of protons that are bunched in 25 nanosecond chains, 40 million times a second, meaning you get billions of collisions per second. It's based on 9 Tesla superconducting magnets. You can see the schematic of the LHC ring sitting on the map. There's Lake Geneva, there is the CERN site down here, and you can see it's just an enormous machine. And the little interesting fact is that the amount of energy stored in the LHC is comparable to that of an aircraft carrier going about 30 knots. So these are the 4 experiments. You all have probably heard about the different experiments. I'll just remind you again, ATLAS is what I'll focus on because that's the experiment where all the Canadians are working on. It is a general purpose detector, and its competitor is the compact solenoid CMS, also a general purpose detector sitting at the opposite side of the ring. And there are 2 other experiments. There's the heavy ion experiment, the ALICE experiment. We might even have heavy ions the first time towards the end of next year in the LHC. And there's also a dedicated B physics experiment with the CP modification relates to B. So I'll focus on ATLAS. So here you see the experiments again across the LHC ring, 100 meters underground. ATLAS is actually right across from CERN, so it's very easy to get to. You see the Swiss-French border here in the mountains. It's site. Now, Canada actually built part of the LHC, so this is just a reminder. Canada built part of the so-called warm quadrupole magnets, the MQW magnets. So there are about 50 of these magnets that do some of the beam cleaning in the LHC. You can see that in here being designed and assembled. First of all, they were designed at Triumph, together with CERN. Then they were assembled by Alstom in Quebec, and they've all been shipped to CERN, 50 of them, and they're all installed now in the LHC tunnel. They've actually already been used. So just to remind people that Canada actually did build part of the LHC. Now, what's the physics we can do? Well, you all know that there is a whole range of standard model physics. This is just predicted rates of 10% of the design luminosities. Electroweak, top, beauty, and jets, you know, going from 10 to the 8th events per year, 10 to the 9th, huge, huge cross-sections, such that people claiming LHC is a B factory, it's a top factory, it's an electroweak factory, and maybe even a Higgs factory, if it were, say, 130 GeV, where the Higgs lie. Lies, you get something like 10 to the 5th events per year. And then you go beyond the standard model, for example, SUSY, if it's sort of a scale of the TeV for luminos, you could get the order of 10 to the 4th events produced in collisions per year. Then there are, of course, more exotic models. I'm sure some of you have studied these models, such as mini black holes, that could be produced. Again, this is much more speculative, but you might get the order of thousands of these events per year. So this shows you again just the center of mass energy and cross section on the y-axis. You can see the tetratron, total cross section, and the LHC down here. That's 14 TeV center of mass energy. So the largest cross section is boring, right? It's this sort of soft interactions, something like 70 millibar in cross section, just sort of soft low PT physics, QCD. If you multiply that rate by the number of interactions, you get something like 700 megahertz, because you actually have 25 events piled up on top of each other on average in each collision. That's actually what they look like. This is sort of a pileup event. But in fact, this is a golden Higgs event. So perhaps some of you, if you have good eyesight, you can see the Higgs decaying into two Zs and four muons. But if you filter out the low PT tracks, you can actually dig out a needle from the haystack to see the four muons coming out. And there's a Higgs decay there. So remember, the Higgs is way down here. This is the cross section. So many, many orders of magnitude below the sort of QCD cross section. You see the rate for B core production, W and Z production, jets above 100 GeV, and then the Higgs, depending on its mass, is a really, really tiny cross section. That's why you need such a high luminosity collider to take it out. Yes?
I know the right time to ask this, but science. 2 weeks ago, a week ago, Tevatron 6 inverse vector bands in the guy 10 on the phone. What do you think?
I can show you a slide at the end, but what I think is that, well, there are two things. The Tevatron has already ruled out Higgs at a certain point, right? Where it's easiest to find. And personally, if the Tevatron, for me, if it sees a hint of the Higgs, I'm fine with that, because when you turn the LHC on, you can go bang, you can really see the resonance. It's very unlikely that you're going to get a 5-sigma discovery at the Tevatron with this sort of luminosity. But 3 is fine. I mean, then you get a hint. It's not quite a discovery, but it's enough to say, well, the U.S. is doing well, and then come along and nail it down. So, I mean, at some point, center of mass energy just blows away. But it's
an end to then, but then the U.S. can we discover the Higgs?
Well, maybe you can claim some joint discovery. I don't know. You add the data from the two together, and you get 5. I don't know. I mean, I say that because funding for high-energy physics in the U.S. is, of course, not as good as it could have been in the past. So, as long as we find other things, I'm quite happy.
Well, Obama will pump up the hint.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But it's still very, very hard. It's still, I can show you a plot. It's still very, very hard.
That 170 ruling out at that point, there was an expected curve of what they could rule out, and then it was the 1-sigma band. So it was a fluctuation.
It could
so with more data,
fluctuation.
It would fluctuate that. Right?
Yes.
So they haven't really ruled anything out.
Yes. that's a fine point. You're right. Yes. So if we can mention a bit more about just the way you could find the Higgs of the LHC. So these are just the different production diagrams. So remember, you're mainly colliding glue. So you can be getting a Higgs through gluon gluon fusion through a top loop. You can open up the loop, you can get top production in the final state. You can have radiation from a W and Z Hampshire, or you can have vector boson fusion. And this just shows you the different cross sections. Remember, it's different from the tetratron, which is proton antiproton. The LHC is proton proton, so it's really mainly a glue glue collider. That's why this cross section is so huge. Now, where you're actually going to search for it, well, it depends, right? It depends on the mass, of course. At least what the standard model takes. This just shows you the different branching ratios. Now, the BB bar cross section is simply two targets. It's swamped by the standard model B production. So, typical one people claim is a benchmark for low mass states. So this is 114 where it's ruled out. It takes the gamma gamma, and then as you start going higher in mass, you turn on the WW pair production, and of course, if you go above the twice the Z mass, you get this very beautiful golden channel of the ZZ production. Now, the low energy channel that I mentioned takes the gamma gamma. Here's just an example. This is the hardest channel to look for. And don't forget, this plot is zero suppressed. So this is an example of 100 introspective arcs, how you start to see a peak. That's a very high luminosity measurement, around 130 GeV. And if you do the background subtraction, you do get a signal there. So the main thing that drives this is for the detectors to have very, very good calorimetry, very, very good electromagnetic energy resolution. Yes.
That was for Atlas, right?
Yes, that's not combined.
Yeah, because CMS could be a little better.
Actually, these have been updated, and I can show you at the end. It's actually gotten better in Atlas once we start adding a few more things. At the moment, in the past, it looked like CMS was a little bit better. Now when you compare the most recent results, they look just about the same.
That's great.
Yes, yes. That was something we were very happy with. So if you go a little bit higher in mass, so this is where you can start turning on ZZ production. This is an example for 130 GeV, one of the Zs will be virtual. You start getting a very good resonance. I mean, this is the simulation, of course, but you can see here just 30 inverse functor bars. You see a huge peak of the Z coming out, and then the standard model background. Right? So that's a very good example of how you can find it. And then that same channel over a range of masses, 5183. It's a very easy signal to pick out. Then there's just one other channel I can mention, this vector boson fusion channel. So why is that interesting? Because in eta, in the direction of the detector, so this is eta of 0 is pointing straight up, and then these regions are either side towards the beam line. You could see two tagging jets, and then nothing in between, just because there's no fragmentation, it's just the W and Z. And you see the decay products of Higgs, two tagging jets, you can see the same thing here in eta. This is the signal of the two tagging jets. And the background has a very different distribution. So this is another channel that people have looked at to try and complement the search for the Higgs with an interesting signature. Okay, now you all know that there's a problem with the Higgs, that why doesn't it just couple all the way up to the Planck scale? Why doesn't its mass, why does it stay at the electroweak scale? Why does it stay at the QGV? So, of course, one solution is just to claim fine-tuning, that you tune the parameters all the way down to many, many orders of magnitude, and the Higgs stays light. That's not a very natural solution. So, of course, one model that people propose that you all know is supersymmetry, and basically you can correct with, it's basically a negative sign, right, in different quantum corrections, and you can suppress the Higgs mass and keep it light. So this, of course, got people, again, excited about supersymmetry. It's a very general model, very general symmetry. It doesn't mean that it's right. It may still be, you know, you say you're doubling the number of particles. Maybe that's just not realistic. But at least it has this additional effect. It seems to suppress a heavy Higgs mass and keep it light.
There's another solution. There is no Higgs.
I know this. Yes. So if I understand correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, we would see at high energy the lack of W and Z production. Is that right?
You would see differences in the amplitudes.
Yes.
I've since proved that unitarity is not violated above a TeV in this model.
So if we measure the expected electroweak cross-section, well, if we measure it compared to the expected electroweak cross-section, how big a deviation do we need to see before we start claiming something?
Well, I still have to do a lot of radio correction stuff. But this is enough. The problem is you have to be able to measure the longitudinal polarization of the button. Because that reflects this electrostatic symmetry breaking.
Okay, yes.
So when you can do that, then when you do the scattering aperture, it's about to, you will see a difference between my model and the Higgs model.
Can you do it without polarization, just cross section?
Well, E plus E minus into WW. It's done by a left of 260 dB with half a percent error.
Yep.
Unfortunately, my deviations are above 260 dB. Besides, you need the international linear collider.
Okay.
So
my question was, how much integrated luminosity we need to see, to start saying something about that? Is it an extremely bar? Is it?
You have enough. Yeah.
Typically, studies of this strong WW scattering in Higgsless cases, you're talking about 300 inverse femtobars.
300 inverse
all the full AOC
okay.
Like
yes,
that.
Okay. So we have to wait a bit, but that's certainly possible.
Right, as soon as you turn on about a TV, you'll see something.
So you say the final state should be looking for polarized
WW. This is the best thing to look for.
Okay.
Besides the smoking gun from electric research,
I mean, there are whole groups working on the Dye boson searches, right? So, I mean, just standard electroweak W pair and Z pair production. So, we're absolutely going to measure that. So, it's certainly something people look for. Yes. Okay. Okay, so maybe just one more word on supersymmetry, just to remind you of the two parameters people have chosen, probably five parameters, once you constrain it. But this mass of the scalars, M0 and M1/2, so here's just one example for a set of parameters, where at a high scale, the two masses, M1/2 and M0, are fixed at two points. They're somehow unified. And then you evolve them down to the electroweak scale, and that gives you, say, the mass of the amino, the mass of the spork, and so on. Now, that's assuming R parity, SUSY. But if you use those two parameters, and of course there's the neutralino, the dark matter candidate, remember, if you look at the allowed region, so this is, in this case, 10 beta 10, so one particular choice of parameters in SUSY, the regions of M0 and M1/2 that are left are actually just this tiny little blue region. So this is after you've applied the WMAP constraints on the relic dark matter density, right? You get only a tiny region that's left over. So some people say, well, that's showing you that SUSY is just wrong. And other people will say, no, it's great, because there are only a few regions left where we can look for it. So it depends if it's half full or half empty.
There are other ways of producing dark matter decays.
Sure,
of
yes.
So that's another point of view which says you shouldn't take that those thin bands seriously. Because there are models which give perfectly good dark matter abundances.
So these are axions you're thinking of, or
no, you have for example, we know LSBs, models with monoline.
So you're saying it is still some sort of supersymmetric model?
Yes.
Supersymmetry. Right. Yes. So this is assuming that it's the neutralino in our case. But you're saying that there could be other models like a neutralino where you still have a stable.
Yeah, that's a neutralino as well. Here, typically, in these M-super things, you get a Beno spin as the neutralino.
Right.
The lightest neutralino. But other models of supersymmetric particle masses, for example, this anomaly mediation, that gives you a neutral Weino LSP. And there, you know, if you apply the thermal relic density calculation, you can get. You just say that's not consistent with dark matter abundance that we observe. You get too little dark matter, but you then actually couple it into a realistic model involving gravitino and then moduli. It comes out perfectly fine.
And these are still at mass scales that we can produce.
The Weinos would be 200 GeV.
Okay, but these are still going to be missing ET signatures.
Yeah.
Okay, so then as long as there's something we can. Can search for it in this in teacher. Okay.
It comes up fine with the thermal abundance or with some non-thermal abundance?
It's non-thermal.
Yeah. Because the message I get from those things is that you've made the mass large enough that you're giving up on the thermal mechanism now, right?
Yeah, exactly. The message from that is that thermal production is obviously not
not the way to go.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, it could
or
be correct.
It's not correct. It's something that
yes. But it's very attractive, and so it's kind of something you don't want to give up. So
I mean, you,
have,
you, have, you have to acknowledge it was one of the selling points. It's yes. Natural.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. There are some good arguments for it, but since,
it's not.
If you go to a supersymmetric phenomenology, you have to couple it to string theory, obviously not. And then you have moduli. Moduli decay into these things and actually dominate the universe and dominate over the thermal production.
But you can do supersymmetry without strings. Why are you bringing strings in?
Strings are the only consistent theory of
physics. Yeah, but now you see those scales are very separated. You would think that the physics of that scale generically, you're saying generically the physics, even though it's so widely separated, is all. I mean, yes, it can produce moduli, which can affect these things. You're saying generically it always has to.
I think without fine tuning, moduli have to be, in a multi TPD region.
I think it doesn't have to be moduli. I have a model with a head axiom. You could produce
So the best you can do is make sure you give and I think you do, a phenomenal electron prediction
time where you can search for it.
And then hopefully we can help answer that question. Okay. So this is just in the MSSM how you could produce SUSY particles. And it just shows you this long decay chain where in the end, in this case where we claim it's neutralinos, the LSP, you get the signature in the detector of missing transverse energy. Remember, you use the transverse energy because it's not balanced in the longitudinal direction because you have two different x's from the proton structure function. But in the transverse direction, it should balance. You get jets and missing ET. But the detector can fake this, so we have to estimate it also as background from the data. This shows you what events could look like. So these, unfortunately, are just simulations to SUSY candidates with jets being produced and missing ET in the final state. And here's an example of a background simulation, just QCD, two jets. This should give you low missing transverse energy, but you can still have fluctuations in the detector that fool you, many other things, other backgrounds, of course, electroweak backgrounds, real missing ET. So one of the challenges will be to estimate what the real missing ET background is and see if we see any excess when we turn it on. Now what that might look like, you can see here, this is just the standard and effective variable where you sum the ET miss events plus the PT and the jets, and this in blue is just the simulation of what the standard model would look like. And one model of SUSY is plotted here where you see really a big excess starting to indicate perhaps some sort of discovery of SUSY. So this is what people call the sort of discovery plot for SUSY, but there's a lot more you can do with that. Well, first of all, the peak that seems to sort of track the typical scale of the masses of the SUSY particles. You can see if the peak moves an effective mass, you can sort of trace the scale. Then you go on with higher luminosity, and we'll show you at the end, you can do actually some sort of precision supersymmetry. So let's spend a few words about the experiment. So this is the view of the detector from a theorist's point of view. You can see different particles coming through.
Nice day.
So you have a tracking chamber, electromagnetic calorimeter, hadronic calorimeter, muon chambers, and you see how the different particles may or may not leave tracks, and then showers going from the inside to the outside. So what Canada worked on is the electromagnetic and hadronic calorimeters ATLAS. So there you see ATLAS in the experimentalist viewpoint. You see 46-meter-long detector and 22 meters high. We compared this once to about 1.5 blue whales in length. You see the two beam lines, the interaction point, the inner tracking detectors, the calorimeters outside, so for example, Canadian components are right here, and the NCAP calorimeters are also over here. I've also worked a bit on the hadronic calorimeters that you see up here. And then there's a huge muon spectrometer with a superconducting magnet. That's this section up here. It's actually an air core, so you reduce multiple scattering. And then you have many layers of muon chambers on the outside that would cover about two Canadian football fields if you spread it all out. The whole thing is about 7,000 tons, as much steel as is in the Eiffel Tower, and about 100 million readout channels read out over about 3,000 kilometers of cables. So that also shows you the scale. ATLAS is about 92 meters underground, which turns out to be the height of Peace Tower in Ottawa, and the size is the order of one of the wings of Parliament buildings.
This shows you the size of the Atlas collaboration. So some 2,500 authors from all around the world, 37 countries, 169 different institutions. And we're running out of office space, as you can see. So the Atlas Canada component has now reached about 150 people. It's been going on for almost 20 years now. You see the different universities in Canada that are members of Atlas Canada, together with Triumph, our national particle physics lab. It's about 43 faculty members at the moment. Undergraduate students every summer we take on. Actually, the number of graduate students is even growing. I think it's beyond 60 now. And it's really becoming a huge project as you see graduate students ramping up their interest in joining the experiment. So the focus of Atlas Canada, I talked about the LHC, but Atlas Canada has focused on liquid argon calorimetry. So you can see an example of Atlas Canada work done. Yes?
Do you really need more bodies? I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't have them, I'm just curious.
The thing is, power-intensive things that are in need of. Yes, because you need a critical mass of people if you want to be competitive. When you go back, see this picture. It is, right now we make up something like 6% of the experiment. So to be competitive, you need a very coherent group of people that works in the same time zone together. That's why you actually need a lot of people. It's not that there are not enough people in Atlas. If you want to be, let's say, competitive with the Canadian group, really need a lot of people to work together. I mean, there are groups that are as large as Atlas Canada working away. That's why you need to be competitive. You need to do an analysis to be the first to actually find something like the Higgs. You actually do need a big group. You can't just do it with one or two people.
So that's not, that, so you're going to have multiple people internally in the experiment competing against one another, different groups?
There will be competition, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there'll be different analyses. We'll try and compete to be the published analysis, say, for it. Certain Higgs discovery, or Susie discovery. Yes?
I don't want to waste your time.
Never.
One of my favorite questions, when you publish a paper that announces the discovery of the Higgs particle, you could have put all 2,500 Higgs on it?
Yes. There's a story, one of my colleagues in Toronto was looking at a paper, and a theory colleague came in and said, oh, you've got the first Atlas paper, and was flipping through it. This is just the author list. That's all it was. So how are we actually going to do that? You're not going to publish it in every single paper, right? The journals won't accept that. So the different ideas. One is to publish the author list once a year, and then the other papers refer back to that.
Is that a DVD disc for 2,500?
Well, we actually did publish an Atlas paper in the FX journal, and it's got all the authors on it. That was one that I showed you. All the authors on it. It's simply unfair to leave people out for whatever reason.
Well, we had a speaker here the other day, Franzoni, and he said there's a selection committee that cancels out people who haven't done enough.
For CMS.
That's CMS. Mm-hmm.
That's
well,
CMS.
It is true.
Okay, that's CMS.
That there is a level to qualify as an author on practice. That is absolutely true. You must have done some service work.
Fetch about Coca-Cola.
No, you have to work on a certain technical aspect for at least a year with a good fraction of your time. And then there's sort of an honor system that you keep contributing every year to some useful task. There's also a system where you have to do your fair share of shifts and things like that. And obviously, if someone starts being very obviously inactive, there will be some questions and flags raised. But it's also done sort of at a national level. So, you know, within Canada, we could say, well, we think this person has to go off the author list because blah, blah, blah. So it's not the experiment itself that will tell us that. It's more the country.
If one person gets dropped off the author list, doesn't that mean you have to republish the whole author list again? Because it wouldn't exactly be fair to say, you know, this was published by our collaboration minus this person.
There are ideas that we put it on some sort of web page and have it, you know, vary in time. With a certain paper, this is the author list.
It changes every single day, the author list.
It must fluctuate.
But there are deadlines, right? I mean, for the paper we published in December, it was a hard cutoff. If you didn't get on the author list by then, you're finished. You don't get to appear later just because you were a latecomer. So yes, there may be fixed times in the year when you have to qualify as well.
Okay, so the bounce price. So I'm wasting your time.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'd be happy if someone like Lynn Evans were to share that. You know, he's the LHC project leader. He's one of the people that's really driven the project. And there are other people, then it gets harder. But I think he is a, I think, pretty uncontroversial choice. Without him, there's no LHC. And then you say the experiments, I don't know, to give it to each spokesperson, to give it maybe the way they did with the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. They actually gave it to the whole organization. It's a fractional prize, maybe a fractional prize to discern.
So you can say the Bound Prize only allows three.
Only allows three, yeah. So maybe that's how you do it.
Captain.
Yeah. No, an institute. An institute can count as one, I think. I think for the Peace Prize, they counted it. It was Al Gore, the head of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate
Change. This is
the
Peace Prize.
I don't think the Peace Prize is an official Nobel Prize.
Ah, so you say you can't divide it into rules.
The Physics Prize is the
Peace Prize.
So you want to say an institute doesn't count as a person. Okay. Well, maybe the Director General, you could argue. Well, Director General is the Director General. So if I can just mention what we built in Canada, this shows you a simulation of a particle going through a liquid argon calorimeter. So this is based on a heavy absorber. In this case, it's lead. And then layers of liquid argon cool down so that it ionizes as the particle goes through. There's a 2 kilovolt high voltage. You drift the ions, you get a pulse that's proportional to the energy of the incident particle. And this gives you a very radiation hard calorimeter. It gives you very, very good resolution, 10% over square root of E. And it's also a very massive detector, as you can see here. This is the order of a 100-ton detector. This was assembled in pieces in Canada. And then, yes?
Does the pulse going along the zigzags?
Well, the shower is going along like this. The zigzags are there to give it many, many interactions, many samplings with the lead.
When you read it out, are you reading
it? You read it out at the back. So there are planes, pads, coming out of the plane in this direction. That actually give you sampling of the shower shape as it goes along. Yes, coming out in this direction. That's how you read it. And then you sum that up at the end. You get different layers and samplings and electrical pulse and shape. So this is what it's like when it's assembled. You see a typical graduate student working away at it. You see people there giving the order of the scale. One of the hadronic NCAP calorimeters in 2004. There it was being transported at CERN. That was a photo I took as it was being brought, one of these two NCAP calorimeters being brought into Atlas. They had to stop all the traffic in front of CERN and slowly bring this across. Then they lowered it down into the detector, so you see the view from above as it's being lowered down on these two cranes, and this is the beam line of Atlas. Now you see it assembled with the outer shell of the hadronic calorimeter, the tile calorimeter, and there it is being brought into Atlas. So this is just a little blurb, you don't have to read it all, but sort of the design characteristics of Atlas. So we talked about high resolution calorimeters. If you can find things like Higgs-Decatur gamma, they have to be hermetic. They have to cover the whole range of the detector. You don't want holes in it. If you're going to measure missing ET, you need a calorimeter that covers the whole eta range. For eta, it's just this log of 10 or theta over 2. You need a high resolution muon spectrometer and very good vertex resolution. And the whole thing has to work at about 40 megahertz beam crossing. So I mentioned the liquid argon calorimeter, the other technology for the hadronic calorimeter, which is something I also worked on for a while. You see here the so-called tile calorimeter. So you see a simulation of a particle going through, and the layers of steel initiate a shower. And then you read out the light from many, many layers of scintillating plastic. It goes along the photomultiplier, well, wavelength shifter, and the photomultiplier too. And this is part of the detector that's crucial for the missing T and jet measurements. So again, this is a very important calorimeter for 5 megahertz supersymmetry. This shows you just one module of the tile calorimeter. So this would be the interaction point up here. Particles showering down like this and collected the light along wavelength shifting fibers into fiber bundles, which are, of course, different from fiber bundles that you work on in theory. Now, this is some of the electronics for reading out that calorimeter. This is, you might say, the mother of all motherboards. This is 1.5 meters long. It's actually sitting on the detector and 256 of these. And this does the shaping of the signal from each of those 10,000 photomultiplier tubes. It does all the digitization and converts it into an optical signal that's sent out to fiber optics to the counting room.
So why does it have to be so long? You don't want to have it on two boards or something? You have a bottleneck of...
If you go back here, only space to put in the front-end electronics is at the end of the module here. So the module itself is this very long object that you saw here. And there is a little access point at either side where you can bring the electronics in. You actually have to physically, that's why it's called a drawer, push it in and pull it out.
Oh, so that's why it can be segmented.
Yes. I guess you simply have no other access to it. So that was the calorimeter, two calorimeters, just one page on the tracking. So we actually have three technologies, a pixel, inner detector for looking at key lifetimes, and then silicon layer, and then a so-called transition radiation tracker, a gas-based tracker on the outside. The order of 10 microns is the precision you can get. And here are real cosmic ray particles going through this transition radiation tracker. So it's already working. There's a tiny section that was not working, but it's now switched on. And there you see some of it being installed in Atlas for the inner tracker. That was the tracking. And then just one page on the muon chambers. Remember, we talked about these two Canadian football fields. You could cover with the muon chambers. Another part that is impressive are the so-called big wheels. So at either ends of the detector to get muons, they're coming out like this. So the this would be the incoming beam. The interaction point would be way over here, and the particles coming out like that. And you can see from the scale of the people here, these are just giant systems that are now complete and running inside Atlas, giving you something like 10% resolution, let's say, a TeV muon. So to build all of this, well, there was, of course, a lot of civil engineering. This shows you what Atlas looked like in the year 2000, that we were digging out an entirely new tunnel. The existing LEP caverns were not big enough to build Atlas inside. So they went on and started excavating the whole area, these machines working away, and then building the reinforced concrete floor. This was 2002. And the civil engineering was completed in 2003. This is what it looked like in 2004. So this was a photo I took working with some colleagues from the United States and France and Italy and other countries. And here we were testing out the first signals, in this case from the tile calorimeter, which was half assembled right here. There's a beam line. And the funny thing is that even though you're 100 meters up, 100 meters below ground, you're actually working at height. So if you're scared of heights, it's a strange thing to be doing. But anyway, there's an example of someone working underground with a laptop. This is what it looked like. Then in 2005, you see some very brave people working away, way up here, finishing some of the components of the muon system. These are superconducting magnets. There's actually a picture of them being lowered as they were assembled. So these were so big, they couldn't be lowered horizontally in the access shafts. They had to be down at an angle. And these were probably the most critical steps in Atlas, because if we drop that, well, that's the end of the experiment. So that's why people call it a bit like a ship in a bottle. There's this famous picture looking down the beam line. You see all of the eight superconducting barrel toroid magnets assembled. You see the barrel calorimeter starting to be brought in. And you can see the whole thing will be assembled by one person. You see, now and then we have visitors from the Perimeter Institute, as you can see here. So the next step we did once we assembled everything was to begin commissioning it with cosmic ray muons. This is just a simulation of 15 minutes of cosmic rays blasting through the Atlas cavern and giving us signals that we can look for in the detector. And this was the first signal we saw in Atlas. In this case, it was in the tile calorimeter. So muon coming down like that. Even Nature got excited. They published that. So that was the very first test that we did. Since then, we've collected a lot more cosmic ray data that lets us test the whole chain from the trigger to the readout to the software over the grid. We see muon going through the muon chambers, the tile, the different layers of the calorimeters. You see here a muon shower going through. So these are all real events. They're not simulations. You can see tracks now being reconstructed. So this was another nice test that the thing is alive and it's actually working. So the next step, is to commission the detector with beam. So there you see people assembling some of the interconnections between magnets and the LHC. There you see the last dipole magnet that was delivered in 2006. This is dipole magnets up to 15 meters long. And these were produced, 1,200 of them in industry, and brought to CERN. There you see the last LHC dipole being lowered down into the LHC. And here you see a blow up of the schematic. So the beam line, the two proton beams, are into one magnet. There you see one beam there and one beam there. And then the superconducting material is actually around each of those two beam lines. And it's running at liquid helium temperatures, right? So 1.7 Kelvin. So people claim it's the coldest ring on Earth, perhaps even in the universe. It's actually tons and tons of liquid helium that's used for the whole system to give you this 8.7 Tesla magnetic field.
So you had like 50 or so extra magnets, and you just had to replace. But how many in the end need to be replaced?
The number that have to be replaced is the order of 20 magnets.
Okay. And if you do, over years, need more magnets, more can be ordered? Like,
they are being made.
They are.
In fact, they've restarted the assembly line to make new spares. Because essentially, we've used up all the spares.
Yeah.
So we're making new spares. This shows you a moment where we actually closed the LHC beam line. It turned out that Atlas was the last place to close the ring. So now the whole ring is complete as a beam. This was, can't quite see, but it was last June, 2008.
Is the company that's making the spares the same one that made the original magnets?
Yes, yes. We had to bring back some of the technicians. And yes. So then we went on to the exciting day in September 10th for first beam. So this was first injection of beam into the LHC, so you see one of the transfer lines, and it brought the beam along up to this quarter of the LHC. And you can see in the beam pickup, you can see the LHC was actually getting beam all the way there on the very first shot. So people were amazed. They didn't lose the beam, they actually went that far. Here you see Atlas is down here and CMS is up here. So I'm going to try the next step in the other direction. Of course, you have to inject in two directions if you're going to get counter-rotating beams. And it worked on the first shot. Again, you can see in the beam pickup monitors, there was the beam going all the way through. It went farther, they got the beam all the way around to CMS and then stopped it, dumped it, that worked. And then people got very excited in the control room with all the cameras watching, and they decided to go all the way around, it worked. Got the beam going all the way around in one direction, and then a little while later on the same day, all the way around in the other direction. People were crying, actually, at this point. They were just so happy. One Canadian woman that said it was like being pregnant for 20 years, and finally seeing that.
You would be crying.
Now, that's only going around once with the beam. Obviously, for a collider, you need to go around and around and around millions of times. So the next step was to turn on the radio frequency system, right? The system that gives the beam a kick of energy each time it goes around. So this is what the beam looks like. This is time in this direction. This is the beam profile with that RF system turned off. And of course, after a few turns, you just lose the beam, right? It loses energy and it's gone. So then they started turning it on, and it didn't work, of course. The beam got blown up and destroyed, and you couldn't get it to work. So, well, they adjusted it a bit. They got the sign wrong, and the beam sort of wandered off and died. And then, after the next try, it worked perfectly. Now you see the beam, each cycle, the constant amplitude just going on and on and on. So they thought this would take weeks. It actually took about a day to get the radio frequency to work. They captured the beam. They synchronized everything, and they could get the LHC to work. So that just got people amazingly excited that the LHC was. Now this is a picture of the first beam, so single beam, not colliding beams, in Atlas. So what they did was to close the collimators about 100 meters outside of Atlas, fire the beam on it, and then you see the spray of particles that go through the detector. You see these green histograms giving the energy that's measured in the calorimeters. All these tracks are many, many muon segments. This is more energy than we'd see in a collision, just blasting thousands and thousands of particles through, but it's certainly very dramatic. This is looking down the line of the beam line, and everything worked. It was just amazing. And people were very excited at the Atlas control room, and there was just a huge cheer. So there you see another view of that same picture, the first beam event in Atlas. And again, you can see it was just exciting to see the whole chain from the detector down to the software working. So what is the future? Well, we hope this is the future towards the Higgs Road. As I mentioned, The LHC is designed to search for the Higgs over the whole range of masses. This actually extends up to TeV. For example, you see the Higgs to gamma-gamma here. You see the QQWW channel. If you add them all up, you get this black curve that combines them. Actually, this has even been improved since then. This is case 30 inverse femtobarns, but with a better understanding of the detector and better techniques, we're actually getting this even more sensitive than that. So it will certainly take a few years. It depends on the Higgs mass, but it should be the whole range that's covered. Here's a simulation of a Higgs going to ZZ star, and then you see the electrons. So one electron here, showering in Kalerunger, another electron there, and then the two muons going out here. This was the first Higgs that was seen in Atlas. It was in 2008. The Higgs came for a visit. The other thing that, of course, we hope for in the data that we're going to take is to find something beyond the standard model. So here's the example of supersymmetry. Again, you remember the M1/2 and M0 plane. Now, just if it's a strong cross-section, if you're producing sporks, you should be able to exclude a whole region, even with 100 inverse picobars. Now, of course, that's assuming that you can understand all the fake backgrounds. So the missing ET signature is very challenging because you can fake it with electronics noise, with cosmic rays, with pileup, with many other things. But once we understand the data, a small amount of very good data should allow us to cover or exclude the whole range. There you see one inverse femtobar and 10 inverse femtobars. Those are the five sigma discovery curves. So that's very helpful. And as you go to high precision, if supersymmetry is the right model, you can do things, again, if it is the dark matter candidate, you can do things like a relic density to, you know, better than 10%. That's an example with 300 inverse femtobars. You can really start measuring if it is dark matter candidate, the relic density in the cross section. You can also do precision spectroscopy of the different SUSY particles. So there's quite a lot that one can do. These are examples where they're around, you know, 600 TeV. So you got to go to the airport?
Yeah, sorry.
There are many other searches you can do. It's almost finished. You know, there's excited quarks, leptic quarks, composites, maybe fourth generation searches. Many of you know about extra dimensions, of course, probably better than I do. I can just give you the example that, you know, maybe we're living just on a four-dimensional brain. Gravity is weak because it can leak out into this extra-dimensional brain. So the signature might be gravitons, missing ET in the detector again. It might be that gravity becomes strong at the TeV scale. And if that is true, then you could see events like this. So this is a simulation of a mini black hole event in Atlas. So this would be a very spectacular signature. We see an excess of these events, you know, sort of a hardening of the spectrum. So there certainly should be very easy to see if you're there. So finally, this is sort of one time frame that people have tried to imagine of the discovery potential of Atlas as a function of the integrated luminosity.
Sorry, because you must book for 2 a.m.
Book for 2?
2:30.
2:30.
2:30.
2:30.
We're not finished.
It's nearly done.
Normally we're booking every week here, so it's
So time is of the essence, and this is the time frame, but I've removed the year. Integrated luminosity is along here, and these are different discoveries. So that's one inverse femtobarn. This is maybe 10 inverse femtobarns. People claim we would have discovered or ruled out supersymmetry at TeV, Higgs up to 200 GeV, compositeness, maybe 80 the extra dimensions, SUSY 3 TeV, and a Z prime at 6 TeV. So the LHC has a 20-year program, including a luminosity upgrade. So it really is a facility that's been run for 2 decades. Now, what we heard, well, I'll tell you in a minute, this is just one slide about the incident that happened on September 19th. So as you know, in one of the sectors, actually in the very last sector that was being tested, there was a problem with the connection that caused an arc. Now, this is something like a nano-ohms of resistance with 10,000 amps going through it, and it turns out it was probably a bad connection. Out of the thousands of connections in the LHC, there was one bad connection that caused the spark that ruptured the volume that went through the whole system, that allowed several tons of helium to escape into the system. And that destroyed a connection, and that also damaged several magnets in the sector 3-4.
that require warming up the sector, which takes 3 to 4 weeks, and that's, of course, delayed the LHC. Now, the status we heard a couple days ago at CERN, there was a report saying now the repairs are well underway. They've already started putting replacement magnets back underground in that sector where it's damaged. All of the replacement magnets have been put in their cryostat, their cryogenic container. There's a whole new enhanced protection system, which gives you a very large factor of safety. So they don't anticipate that type of incidents happening again. They've also developed a system where they can measure down to nano ohms this increase in current. They found one other magnet. It turns out it had that effect. They removed that. They fixed it. They found it had that connection. So it seems they're quite well prepared for that sort of incident. So the planned restart is this September 2009, so this year, not next year. The first collision should be after a couple of months. And exceptionally, the management has decided to run the LHC during the winter shutdown for a long 11-month run. So that's going to be a 10 TB center of mass energy. It's not at 14 TB because they want to add a factor of safety for the current going through dipole magnets. And they aim to deliver to each experiment between 1 and 300 inverse picofarads a day. Remember, we were talking about looking for supersymmetry, even with 100 inverse picofarads a day. Now, to be fair, you have to factor in the efficiency. So it might be that the detector efficiency is not 100%, maybe it's 50%. So there's still going to be some factor. You'll multiply that number by. People are talking really about the order of 100 inverse picofarads, and then you start to blow away the competition.
This is only 0.2 inverse picofarads.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you have to get way up.
Sure.
How long is that going to take?
That will take a couple of years. I mean, it depends how the machine turns off. They claim that they're going to deliver as much integrated luminosity as we can take. So, you know, some machines turn on like this, some machines turn on like that. We don't know yet which one.
These things about the improved cryostats and the finding the electromagnet, is that only in sector 3-4?
No, that was in a different sector. They tested every single night.
So the whole ring has been tested?
Yeah.
And the enhanced patch protection, is that something which is only in 3-4?
It's the whole ring.
All the whole ring.
Okay, so if we have 4 minutes, we have one little video. The Atlas experiment. So we'll quickly zoom in on the CERN site.
In a 27-kilometer underground ring near Geneva, protons are accelerated to near the speed of light and collide it. Here at the CERN laboratory, scientists can recreate the conditions of the universe immediately after the Big Bang. The huge Atlas detector, which studies these collisions, took several years to assemble, but through animation, we can watch it in a few minutes. Throughout much of the Atlas detector, there is an intense magnetic field. This is produced by passing current through about 80 kilometers of superconducting cables housed within a large toroidal structure. This enables Atlas to maintain one of the world's largest volumes of intense magnetic field. It is important to measure the energies of particles which pass through the detector. This is done by a device known as a calorimeter. Atlas has several types, which are arranged as barrels placed in both the center and at the ends of the detector. The 3,000-ton tile calorimeter is composed of steel and a special material which lights up when particles pass through. The tile calorimeter surrounds a second calorimeter, which consists of lead bathed in liquid argon, which is cooled to -180°C. This is known as the electromagnetic calorimeter. Outside of the calorimeter, there is a further component which measures the trajectory of charged particles called muons that reach the outermost layers. The surface area of this component, the muon detector, is around the size of several football fields. Now, let's look inside the detector. Here we can see in more detail the pieces of individual components. The tile calorimeter. The electromagnetic calorimeter.
So those were two pieces built.
The transition radiation tracker and the silicon devices. In reality, a scientist would not be allowed to walk through the open detector, but in this case, it illustrates the sheer scale of the Atlas detector. Now, we can finally witness the Atlas detector measuring the particles from the colliding protons. A typical collision produces many hundreds of particles, and each component of the Atlas detector is necessary to build a full picture of the collision. If you want to know how it all works, don't miss episode 2, The Particles Strike Back.
Amazing.
There's a quick comment. There's also a really beautiful time lapse video of Atlas being detected on YouTube that I think is 1 second per day.
It's amazing how much has gone on YouTube. But you're right, I've seen that one. It actually shows the construction.
It's a great video also of the black hole eating the earth.
Yeah. And they got it right because it starts to see a mess.
Do you have a patient in Geneva being annihilated?
The whole planet.
The whole planet.
Okay.
So if there's questions, feel free. They've moved to another room, so it's not like we're pressed for time. So.
There's one serious consequence of the Higgs model, which is you calculate the vacuum density in a way the Higgs mass. And you allowed to fight for 4 potential. It's 10 to the power 56 times too big to get the observational value and the vacuum density.
You mean
cosmological
constants? Yes.
And there's no particle physics focus. You just take the standard model, plug in the Higgs mass, assume lambdas of order 1, and bingo. Mm-hmm. It's the worst prediction. Well, the worst is 10 to the 22. The 10 to the 56 decimal places fine-tuning is ridiculous.
So you mean the Higgs mass or the vacuum expectation value? You mean the self-gravitation of the vacuum expectation value? I mean, I don't.
The vacuum density.
The vacuum density
is obtained from the verb of the potential.
Yes. So
the electrically scaled to the place of
G. But let me understand this. There's one claim. If you couple gravity to the vacuum expectation value, you should be able to just shrink the universe to football. Is that the same thing you mean? Or?
Yeah, yes. Feldman published this in 1974. He doesn't like to hit particles for that reason.
Who? Feldman.
Feldman.
Teeny Feldman, yes.
Yeah. So this is, in a way, worse than the mass fire article. And you can't get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the cosmological
problem? You don't even
need a cutoff. You're talking about the cosmological
problem? Yeah, it's the wrong side of it.
So, But the question is, does a cosmological constant have any effect on that? Does it suppress that or not? That's not the answer.
Well, it's to do with acceleration of the universe.
Yes.
All that stuff. So,
yeah, it does. I mean, because that term could be absorbed in a cosmological constant.
So it could balance, but it's fine tuning.
But it's fine tuning, you're saying.
Right. 56 decimal places.
Yeah. So you're saying that in that respect, it's not natural. So Feldman was the first to point that out. Okay, I should look that up.
That's why you're going to see extra dimensions.
This is why you won't
detect.
This is why you won't detect the Higgs part. This is the obvious solution to the problem.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about betting a year's salary, so you two are going to make
that. I had one bet going with Rothstein, Ira Rothstein, $100, 4-year closure. Do you want to bet?
What's the list of that?
That we won't see the Higgs part.
And you're betting that you won't?
Yeah.
And the Higgs particle means the standard model Higgs particle?
The what?
The standard model Higgs particle.
Yeah, it's an elementary particle.
4 years.
Is what they're looking for. No one's ever detected a spin zero particle with positive parity.
Yes.
It's elementary.
Except for
the Higgs. That's not an elementary particle.
Well, it depends on the scale you ask.
All right.
So why isn't the big concept to start?
Because they want to equip all of the sectors with pressure relief valves. That's part of what takes the time.
That's what did the damage, was the release of the helium.
Yes. So they're adding in a whole extra layer pressure relief valves that will be able to stand something like a factor of safety of 4 up to a factor of safety of 20 on that sort of condition. So they don't anticipate that happening again. But then there's the whole commissioning again. You know, you start back at scratch. So it's being done very cautiously, very conservatively. So that's part of the reason why it just takes so long.
In fact, if 20 means that 20 magnets could go off all at once, and that would be okay.
No, it's actually 20 times the expected pressure.
So how many magnets? What was the last one?
The last one was something like the order of 20 dipoles that were damaged. And when they say factor of safety, they mean in terms of pressure that's being induced.
So how much pressure was induced in the last?
I don't know the exact pressure, but I know it was 2 tons of liquid helium that were released almost instantaneously. It was just not designed for that.
But these new pressure valves can handle it?
They can actually handle that, yes. They're designed to handle such a catastrophic loss.
Was this at the upper limit? Was this like a 20 times limit, or was it like a few? You know?
I don't know the exact number, but it was several times what was the design. Yes.
So they did foresee the idea of several magnets quenching all at once. They just didn't see 20 of them.
Yeah, they had foreseen the case of a beam going into a magnet, you know, and causing a quench there, or maybe a couple of magnets, but not. You know, 20 all at once, just blowing all the helium. Yeah. Plus physical energy, shifted magnets on their supports.
Yeah, there's it on YouTube somewhere, there's a movie of that. We were sure of that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's
yes.
But if that happened again, and the law works, they won't need to replace the magnet, but would they still need to go in and change the valve?
No, the valves will be okay. So the idea is to remove any sort of mechanical damage to the system.
Will they still need to?
You have to go in and then repair the fault.
Oh, okay. So
sure, but you don't destroy the packets. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, it could be in the worst case, you might have to warm up that sector, yeah. And that induces a 3 to 4 week delay. And that's sort of one fundamental thing you cannot remove the others. That to really warm up a sector and fix it takes 2 months, and you have to fix it, which you might do in a few days. You know, on a normal room temperature machine, this would be an accident. It's not too bad, and you can fix it in a few weeks. But you have to add in this 2-month period of warm up and cool down. So that's sort of the one challenge with the superconducting machine.
What is the slow? I understand that you need to cool it slowly, but why do you have to warm it so slowly?
I think, and I'm not an expert, I think to avoid any damage to the system, you really have to do very slowly. If you just dump all the helium on, you can mechanically damage things. I mean, things contract and expand by tens of centimeters, actually. And this was even another problem they found in between the beam, in between every magnet, they have these radio frequency fingers, as they call it. And as they contracted and expanded, sometimes they got caught. They worked right into the beam line. That was another problem they discovered. And now how do you test for that, right? Now you've got this thing blocking the beam line. The only way they could find it initially was to, with a warm system, was to put an endoscope down and find that point. But now you've got over thousands of points in the ring. So what they did was they put basically a golf ball and put a radio frequency transmitter inside it and blew it pneumatically down the ring. And the beam picked up 40 megahertz, which is the signal, could see where it would stop. It'd go and open up that section and fix the fingers. So that's another trick. So you cannot just do it very quickly. Yes.
Supposing, for example, that the Higgs would be something like the top condensate, but not in the above model, but dynamically generated, for example, within the standard model. This, in what kind of process you will set for this kind of composite Higgs?
So I'm not an expert on this, and probably some of you are more experts, but what I can say, they're models of composite Higgs, you know, like Technicolor is one model. And if I understand correctly, you predict resonances like a Techni pion or some sort of strong condensate, which you could actually see as a resonance, some sort of massive particle that might decay in the detector. So there are predictions of resonances. Now, as far as I know, Technicolor models are disfavored at the moment. But there are people
who are searching. That is not needed the highest scale, because perhaps the Google at least. If it is generated at a lower scale, at the proper scale of standard models, for example, in what kind of process you would say for
Well, you would really look for resonance particles. If I understand it correctly, mm-hmm. You would look for the production of a Techni rope that would decay in standard model particles.
The same thing that I can tell you.
Maybe the TV scale. I don't know if you want to comment anything on that. That's what I know about Technicolor.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that. There's always other particles.
I think in your case, if it's a top condensate, you might look for it as a resonance in DT bar production.
Ah, in the DT bar production.
You have to worry about a strong couple in the turret, so you have to. It's a bit of a mess, actually. Because you have to. If you don't wire the unitarity of the TV. Mm-hmm. There's a little Higgs model, which is one of my least favorite models. And it's contrived, you have to put in a lot of extra particles. Yep. You have some rows, so everything fine-tunedly cancels out, so you don't wire the unitarity down. So anyway, they will find out.
Stephen Hawking also has a bet that we won't find.
It's a private thing.
I didn't know that. Okay.
No, no, I just.
it's already on the archive. It's all recorded.
It's online, all right?
So this is probably, we can continue the discussion offline, and we should thank Richard one more time.